introduce the topic and myself. I'm Leif Fixum with American Farmland Trust. For those of you who don't know who American Farmland Trust is, we're a nonprofit organization that originally focused on farmland preservation, mainly focused on ag easements, protecting the acre of land. And over time, our mission has evolved to kind of approach that from three different aspects. One is protect the acre, two is protect the farmer, and three is protect the practice, so sound farming practices. And this is kind of where I fit into the organization. I have a background in agronomy, came out of a conservation district. So that's a kind of a quick overview of AFT. This topic and the inspiration for it, for those of you that came to the session last year, was inspired at my first ASA, in that I was sitting in a session and I was listening to a lecture on a potential BMP of digging ponds at the corner of fields to catch nitrate-heavy drain tile water so that it could be caught and then used back on the field during the growing season. And in the state of Washington, we had just gone through a series of lawsuits against five dairies in the Yakima Valley that got challenged all the way up to the federal Supreme Court level, that said basically if you don't have a double lined with leak detection lagoon or pond and you're storing a liquid that has nutrients in it that you couldn't just discharge, and you don't have that double lined leak detecting lagoon, you're in violation of federal RCRA law, which is the law that governs landfills, and you are discharging a solid waste to either the groundwater or the surface water. And so I raised my hand. I was like, well, that your proposal there, if it's not double lined with leak detection, which is like a $1 million lagoon, would put you at risk of third party lawsuits in the state of Washington. So that was kind of the initial thought. I was like, well, all right, in the tri-societies here, we need to make sure we're also not only promoting best science, but we're also kind of making sure it fits into the legal kind of boxes that are being developed across the country. And so this year, I wanted to try and evolve the session to kind of show and highlight more examples of how members of the tri-societies are plugging into this discussion of, okay, what is, sound public policy? What are the good regulatory approaches? What are the good, voluntary approaches? What are the challenges with both of those? And so that's hopefully what we can dive into with this panel discussion. We have five panelists today, and I'll start with Amy Osmus from Iowa. And I got to get my cheat sheet here. Amy's bio is probably one of my favorites, in that you read through it, and it's this list of impressive accolades. She is the vice president and external relations director Osmus Farm Supply in Iowa. It's a family-run organization. And she has accolades such as she was past chair of the Certified Crop Advisors. She recently was appointed to EPA's Pesticide Program Dialogue Committee, has been on numerous committees. She's on the board of directors for the Agricultural Retailers Association, heavily involved in the Weed Science Society of America, on a task force there to bring partners together. And you get down to the bottom, and what does she have a degree in? The liberal arts and graphics design. So it's a great testament of follow your passion, I guess. But our next panelist will be Erica Larson. She's with EPA. She's also on the Certified Crop Advisors Board, is on the Certified Crop Advisor Exam and Procedures Committee, and is a chapter council member for the Soil and Water Conservation Society, or the national chapter there. Our third panelist is Deanna Osmond. We all met her, a fellow of both American Society of Agronomy and the Soil Science Society of America. Numerous distinguished service awards from Corn Growers Association, from ASA, a bunch of other great and impressive awards. Our fourth panelist is Heidi Peterson, who recently joined the International Plant Nutrition Institute. She was formerly with the University of Minnesota and was also recently elected to be the vice leader for the NEQ community, which we're a part of here. Member of the Women in Science Committee and a member of the NSF Phosphorus Sustainability Research Coordination Network. And then our final panelist who just gave the talk, Amy Schober, another past chair of the Nutrients and Environmental Quality Community, a associate editor of the Journal of Environmental Quality, and was the ASA's Environmental Quality Section Inspiring Young Scientist Award, and is the current chair for SARA 17. So why don't you guys all come up, and I might see if I can get us all over here. And so the way we've got the panel organized is I've got a few prepared questions that I'll ask some of the panelists, and then I want to kind of open it up to the audience and kind of see where that discussion goes. So, well, I'm nervous that the microphone won't reach over there, and it'd be nice to get this recorded. Okay. I don't know. Maybe we just give up on the mic?
Or maybe we could just pass it around.
Can we get everybody over there?
Can it come off the video?
Yeah,
did the microphone to do this.
Great. So, my first question I've got directed towards Heidi, so her background, she came out of the state of Minnesota, worked for the state there, was heavily involved in a lot of different guides for BMPs as it relates to ag nutrients and water quality. The coordinator for the Edge of Field program there in the state, correct?
So I was a research coordinator, so a research scientist with the Minnesota Department of Ag. So maybe I'll fill you in with what exactly I did with the agency after I hear the question.
So I'm actually going to back up real quick. I forgot a section in my agenda. I'm going to have everybody kind of go through and talk about what it is that they do and how it plugs into the public policy process. So, Deanna, you want to kick off and we'll just go down the line?
Hey, do you want us to pass the microphone around or what?
Oh, yeah. Let's try and get that as close as we can.
So we have a number of regulated river basins or watersheds in North Carolina, and they all have kind of similar structures. And one of the structures is that the agricultural community is supposed to show a certain percentage reduction in nitrogen and or phosphorus. And the rules are very specific about the tool that had to be developed by the agricultural community. So I led the interagency team that figured out how to put together a tool that could help calculate percent nitrogen reductions based on what the agricultural community was doing. And we knew it had to be really simple because it was going to be done every year by county soil and water conservation folks, but it also had to have science pinning. And so that's been actually quite successful for the most part. The other thing we were tasked in doing is putting together our phosphorus index, which is under the NRCS standard, but because it's under the NRCS standard, it also ends up showing up in our state nutrient management regulations, and I was heavily involved in that. So we've been producing regulatory tools to help show what the agricultural community is doing. We also, just like Amy, I help provide certification training for our nutrient management planners. And again, those requirements are sometimes federally determined, and sometimes they're determined by the state of North Carolina. And so that's primarily what I do.
Okay, hi everyone, I'm Erica Larson. I think I'll just start by saying I'm actually a soil scientist, I'm not a policy lead. I actually worked under Deanna at NC State, so it's quite humbling to be sitting here with her today. So I think Leif had asked me to kind of talk a little bit about in 4 to 5 minutes EPA's role regarding voluntary and mandatory regulations of nutrient management. So I'm going to attempt to kind of brighten the line here in the next few minutes between our voluntary and regulatory program, which starts with a really quick Clean Water Act 101, which I know we're all excited about. Point sources, many of you are familiar with this. Again, I think it's really important that we're on the same page when we go into this discussion to talk about the regulated and non-regulated entities under the Clean Water Act. So point sources are conveyances that discharge, two main points, conveyances that discharge. Non-point sources are basically everything else that's not regulated under the Clean Water Act. Okay, so that's the area that I work in under the non-point source management program. In particular, agriculture is exempt from the Clean Water Act under the non-point source program. So that's a key message that I want to make clear here this morning, is that row crop ag does not have nutrient management regulations under the federal Clean Water Act program. So the National Non-Point Source Program, that's also the 319 program. Some of you may be familiar with this. You may have worked in 319 projects. This program gives grants to states to implement their non-point source program. To be clear, non-point sources are not just agriculture. There are a variety of non-point source issues across the country. That's abandoned mine drainage, septic, unregulated urban ag, hydro modification, forestry, et cetera. So ag is just one area. That's the area that I work on. So there's kind of 319 funds a variety of projects that support state staff. Many people aren't aware that non-point source 319 funds provide support for state staff. There's watershed planning activities, monitoring activities, et cetera. So there's a variety of activities that these 319 non-point source funds provide support to, but they're all voluntary. It's a non-regulatory program again. So I will say that ag and nutrients is a priority for EPA, given the nutrient issue in the water bodies across the country, and that's also reflective in many of the state non-point source programs as well. You'll see that they have identified nutrients in ag as a significant priority. Very quickly, the regulatory side of things, that comes down to our animal ag operations. Many of you are familiar with this, but the CAFOs, so that's concentrated animal feeding operations, those that discharge, so again, the two keywords, CAFOs that discharge, are required to have a permit. So to give you kind of the scope of what that looks like, about 2% of livestock farms across the country are CAFOs. Only about 30% of those are required to have a permit. Those are CAFOs that discharge to waters of the U.S. So that represents less than 1% of livestock farms across the country. And so those permitted animal ag operations are required to develop and implement a nutrient management plan. I'm not going to be able to go into details about all of that this morning, but I think that gives you an idea of kind of where we are as far as nutrient management regulations and policies.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so I come at it from a very different perspective than most of the other people on the panel. I work directly with growers as an advisor. I own an ag retail business. We sell liquid nutrients. So I also am the liaison between the Iowa Certified Crop Advisor Board and the Agribusiness Association of Iowa. Agribusiness Association of Iowa, the Certified Crop Advisors, along with the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship and Iowa State University, oversee the nutrient management reduction strategy for the state. So we get involved in there. You know, AAI was also somewhat involved with the Des Moines Waterworks case. We helped fund some of the defense. People say that was a great win for ag, right? Well, the only thing we won was to prove that you can't sue a drainage district. And so I do believe moving forward, I know the regulation, we talked about this earlier, I know the regulation, but most of the the stuff we deal with is very voluntary. And because of that, and because there's no hard firm regulations, we have people like Bill Stowell and the Des Moines Water Works who think that they can regulate us through the court system. And although the Des Moines Water Works case is over, I don't think that's the last battle that we had, where we'll have to talk about whether or not tile drainage is a point source. And so just moving forward, I know that's something that we'll deal very heavily with. Also on the national level, I do chair ARA's sustainability work group, and we work with Field to Market, we work with SARP and SPARC and all these other alphabet soup groups. I think it's wonderful, I can say this, I think it's wonderful that they are actually looking toward the Certified Crop Advisor and the Ag Retailer Network, because we do, for the most part, hold that trusted advisor position with the grower. And the belief is out there that if we can educate those people that educate the growers, everything's going to be great. I have my opinions on that as well. But for the most part, the reason I get involved is because I do think it's very, very important that the voice of those that advise the grower and the voice of the grower are heard in all of these conversations. And our goal is not necessarily to avoid regulation. A lot of my work is done on the pesticide side, and as you know, that's heavily regulated. Everything that I sell and recommend for use has a label, and the label is a regulation. And so we're not opposed to regulation. What we want to do working with all these organizations is make sure they're reasonable, implementable, and economically feasible to put on. One thing that I would like to point out when we talk about regulations or we talk about voluntary measures, growers and ag retailers and certified crop advisors don't deal just with the issues of nutrient management in their own silo. We deal with the issues of overall production, and nutrient management and sustainability is part of that production, but we really need to make sure we're not throwing up hurdles or trying to get over hurdles in other areas of production to implement some of the suggestions and regulations.
Great. Thank you, Amy.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Heidi Peterson. As Liz said, I work now with the International Plant Nutrition Institute, and I have to apologize. I've only been with the organization now for a whole 6 weeks. And so if I get any questions during the question and answer session that I can't quite answer, I'll have to follow up with you afterwards. So for those of you who are not aware of what the International Plant Nutrition Institute is, you might see the acronym IPNI. But we're a nonprofit, science-based organization really dedicated to the responsible management of plant nutrition, and that's for the benefit of the human family. The partnerships, and thinking about what some of the questions will be that we received today, and thinking about voluntary actions, a lot of the partnerships that we're involved in may be some of them that you're hearing about. So as Amy mentioned, the Field to Market, but also for our nutrient stewardship principles and the practices around that. And so thinking about working at the field level to get the right source at the right place, the right time, and some of the discussion that we'll be able to have today has to do with my past employment. So before coming on to IPNI, I was working with the state of Minnesota within the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So as I mentioned earlier, I was a research scientist there, and hopefully I'll have the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the funding that the state of Minnesota received. It's very different than some of the other states within the United States, and how we're able to use that funding to leverage some of the federal dollars, $319, for example, to address nutrient management issues both at the field scale and the watershed scale. So I look forward to answering some of the questions around that.
Okay, I'm Amy Schober with the University of Delaware, and as I explained to you earlier, I'm involved primarily through a contract with the Delaware Nutrient Management Commission. I provide all of the education for our nutrient management certification program. I also provide a lot of the continuing education for our certified individuals. I'm involved heavily in training CPAs and crop consultants, nutrient plan management planners. I work with DDA and the Delaware Nutrient Management Commission very closely. The Delaware Nutrient Management Commission, again, is an appointed 15-member commission appointed by the governor. They're the ones that make all of the nutrient management regulation decisions for farmers and landscapers in Delaware. So I'm often called to their commission meetings to provide information about the state of the science or work that we've done specifically in Delaware, or work that we've done in collaboration with the other Bay states, Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York. So I'm also involved in a lot of applied research, like Vienna. We work on the phosphorus index. We work on looking at subsurface transport of phosphorus and drained agricultural ecosystems. We have a lot of artificial drainage. So the question about whether or not a ditch is going to become a point source is always a big concern for our growers. I think also providing some technical support to the Chesapeake Bay program. I don't specifically work on any of the stack or GIT teams for the Chesapeake Bay program, but my colleague Jen Volk, who's our environmental quality specialist, she does a lot of that work. So a lot of times when they need information about different agricultural practices, whether it be irrigation or nutrient management, they would come to me for that type of information.
Great. Thanks. So now we can start the questioning. And so my first question is for Heidi, and it goes right back to what she was kind of foreshadowing a little bit, in that how does the state of Minnesota financially support nutrient management in BMP implementation programs? Because these, as I think everybody in the room knows, they don't just magically happen.
In some of the decisions that they've made, and I want to begin with a decision that was made around 2008 when the election was going on. There was a question on the ballot for all the public to vote on, and it was whether or not to increase taxes, sales tax, for additional funding for clean water, the natural resources, parks, the arts, theater, and it was a question that came across where they had to, in order for it to move forward, they had to receive over half of the votes as a positive. Okay, so it wasn't of the people who did vote; it was of the public, and it actually went forward, which was quite a surprise. But having those funds, so that means, so for this coming biennium, 2018-2019, that means that there's somewhere around $220 million that's going to go toward implementation, technical assistance, research, monitoring the water quality. Well, what's great about these funds is that there is a board that helps, or a committee that helps to determine where is it going to be allocated. But the funds that go to the agencies, they can go toward some of the nitrate and groundwater program, which Joshua Stamper with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is here today, and so if anybody has any specific questions, he can answer some of those. So nitrates and groundwater, the edge of field monitoring that takes place, which is a great, unique opportunity within the state of Minnesota to have state-funded edge of field projects. But then also the implementation. So for the water quality reports, so the TMDLs, the water restoration and protection strategies that come out, to actually be able to take some of those state funds
and put them toward cost share dollars, implementation dollars that support some of the federal funding programs and to get more bang for our buck on the landscape. So what's great is with these extra funds, there's more flexibility as to how is it leveraged, how what programs are being supported, but then also it helps to build upon the partnerships. So thinking about where I am now and with the International Plant Nutrition Institute, and thinking about the 4Rs and Fields Market and all of these voluntary programs, it also helps those partnerships because it brings all, it's really improved communication and bringing all the right players to the table to help with 4R certification, for example, within Minnesota. And so it has been an amazing opportunity to engage people at a local level, a regional level, and then also the interactions with the federal NRCS office, USDA office within the state of Minnesota as well. So hopefully that was a kind of a lot wrapped up in an answer, but if there's any specific questions, I can answer those later as well.
Well, and so that pot of money, will that help also implement the new buffer law? And then there's also a nitrate or nitrogen, I'm not sure exactly how that's set up.
So there's a nitrogen, okay, so that, so a couple different things. So the buffer law. So when we think about voluntary versus mandatory, the buffer law is a new regulation that came across a couple years ago. The governor was at the Pheasant Summit and decided it was something that was completely caught everybody off guard. He announced that there was going to be this new buffer initiative. But yes, the funds, when you think about the implementation, the technical assistance dollars that come in from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment, they've created a lot of conversation around how are we going to implement this buffer law. And so requiring varying buffer width along private versus public ditches and waterways, and thinking about how is it actually going to be followed up upon, because it's one of the issues that we see with having something that is regulated and mandatory is the amount of time and money that goes into making sure that there is some response to those people that are not following the regulation. And so if there's no follow-up, then
Regulation.
So some of those technical assistance dollars will also feed through to some of the making sure that the local soil and water conservation districts have the opportunity to get out on the land, help farmers with the questions that they have, and determining whether or not the buffers are within the requirements.
Great. Cool. My next question is for Amy, our CCA on the panel here, is how has your business evolved in the face of increased regulation and litigation? I throw that in there because of both Iowa and Washington.
As a business, as such, we are embracing some of the voluntary measures that are going on in the state. We take that information and we do advise our growers about that information. I wrote down our mission statement this morning because it just hit me this morning. I don't know why I thought of it earlier. But our mission statement is consulting clients with sustainable recommendations to maximize production. And so as a business owner and as we employ our CCAs that go out and are that trusted advisor to the grower, we really are mindful about the voluntary measures that are coming down. The growers are very fearful of the unknown and fearful of the big R word. So we really do have to educate them and talk to them about what are sustainable recommendations. That's such a broad topic. And how does that apply not only to nutrient management that we talk to them about, but also pest management, seed placement, seed treatment, and all of the other issues of production and inputs for production that we talk to them about, and how does sustainability really work into the big picture of that? And then we have to remind them that it's their acre, it's their production, it's their business, it's their life, but yet everybody else wants to have a say in what they can do and they can't do. And that's another very big fear factor when we talk to our growers, especially around nutrient management, threat of regulation, and management on their own ground.
So kind of a follow-up question there. Where do you see moving forward the biggest opportunity for CCAs and ag professionals kind of in this nexus?
I think what we've seen so far in the industry is we have been recognized as that trusted advisor. I think we not only have to have a role in our businesses, but we're going to have a role in the local, state, and national level to be that conduit to give the education and the information to the grower. But more importantly, in my mind, is we're not a one-way stream. We need to actually take back. I wrote down journal articles because we were talking about all the journal articles. Well, farmers and CCAs don't write journal articles, but it is our responsibility to come back and educate the people that are trying to educate us as to what are some of those hurdles to implementation that we look at throughout the production system. So not only in the future are we going to take the information that the scientists and that the agencies and everybody else pass down to us and share that with our growers in an understandable way, we also need to take the information that we know for production on the ground and feed that back up the stream so that anything that does come down is, like I said earlier, implementable, economical, and able to be acted out by the producer.
Great, thank you. My next question is for the other Amy, and that is, aside from your work in Delaware, what other certification programs or educational efforts have you been keeping your eyes on?
Okay, so we're a little unique in the Chesapeake Bay states, and my understanding of regulation is really limited to most of the Chesapeake Bay states. We meet with the other coordinators of the nutrient management programs regularly, so we're pretty familiar with the education that's being provided in the other states. Delaware is the only state that requires a comprehensive certification of all individuals that have more than 8 animal units or 10 or more acres of land. So we're reaching a lot of farmers in our state. Maryland has a voucher training program, but it's not a comprehensive certification. But the other parts of their regulations actually look quite similar to ours, where the requirements for nutrient management planning are for the same, the 8 animal units or the 10 or more acres of land. Maryland also has a requirement for if you gross more than $2,500, so some of the 4-H kids who raise cattle end up having to fall under the nutrient management in Maryland. It's kind of interesting. Virginia, they do some education through DCR, which is their it's one of their state agencies. They do all of the certification of nutrient management planners. Similarly, in Pennsylvania, certification is really only for nutrient management planners. So it's for those individuals who are actually writing nutrient management plans. And if my understanding is correct, in Pennsylvania and Virginia, nutrient management plans are really only required for CAFOs. They are voluntary for other farms. So whereas we require all of our farmers pretty much to have nutrient management plans in Maryland and in Delaware, other states in the Bay watershed only require that of larger operations. I'm trying to think of, we're also the only ones in Delaware who are providing education primarily through extension. Virginia also uses the extension specialists as part of their school, but all of that educational effort is organized at the state agency level rather than at the university level. And I believe Maryland, or Paul's here from Maryland, so Maryland, they do most of their certification too through Department of Ag and then also through the University of Maryland Extension. They have a group of individuals. They also have in Maryland state plan writers. So there is a whole army of nutrient management planners that are paid by extension, essentially, and they can be hired by the farmers to write nutrient management plans and to advise on all things nutrients.
Yeah, I can speak to Washington in that this is a current debate, and I think last year there was at least legislation drafted that I took a look at. It didn't go anywhere, but they're talking about pushing through legislation that would require all manure applications to have a certified applicator applying those nutrients as well. In the state of Washington, it's just dairies that are, doesn't matter what size you are, all dairies have to have a dairy nutrient management plan. And it's the conservation districts that write those plans, but the Department of Ag that enforces them. So, Deanna, kind of a quick similar follow-up question. Are there other water quality trading programs across the U.S.? You may have already covered a lot of this in your talk, but...
Actually, I'm going to change the question. So the question he just asked me is, are there other ways than regulation where you see the community working? So the answer is yes. So most of our regulations, as Erica said, do not emanate from EPA, and I think that's a misconception that a lot of folks have. And so a lot of us are dealing with state regulatory frameworks, and our frameworks vary a bit by, you know, state by state. Even within Chesapeake Bay, they're not all the same. And I think it's important that those regulatory frameworks are there. We saw in North Carolina that we had a terrible problem from swine because Virginia had started regulating their swine, so the swine moved down to North Carolina with no regulations. And so those regulatory frameworks are important, and we can learn from each other, and we can take it back to our state legislators. But the space that I'm really interested in right now is the nonprofit space that is working with supply chain. We have Field Market in the back of the room, and Environmental Defense is doing that, and there are some other organizations that are looking towards the private sector for solutions. They're not direct regulatory frameworks, but they're ways that these supply chain companies can work together, and we see it in North Carolina. So the Environmental Defense Fund is working closely with Smithfield Foods to help reduce nitrous oxides and deal with better nutrient management. So I think that space is something that we really need to keep our eyes on.
Great. I got a few more canned questions, but I want to open it up to the audience right now. So.
So the question has to do with the Minnesota nitrogen fertilizer application regulation that's being discussed right now and is in a review process. And regarding if there's going to be a very strict fall application requirement. Joshua, correct me if I'm wrong. The number of when you look at the number of fall producers who are doing fall application in Minnesota, there is not going to be a large number of producers that are impacted because there's a couple different requirements in terms of those that would be affected, and it would have to be an area that is identified as being highly vulnerable, and that means that there's also been a number of detections of nitrate over the required standard within drinking water wells, the private drinking water wells. And so when you look at those areas and then you look at the number of producers that are doing fall application, it's pretty few. So the numbers are, there's not many who have been doing fall application. So I think when it was originally announced, and there was a lot of misunderstanding about the regulation because people thought it was a blanket regulation, but it really depends upon where you are in the state and then also if you're within one of those high risk areas. So does that answer your question? And Joshua, did I have it kind of correct?
No, the reason I asked that question, and that question is more related to N. Now you can see the main player in the marketplace selling nitrogen as fertilizer, right? You know that what's happening in the region. Everyone is trying to have that market share. So through the regulation, you know, how you look 5 years from now, 3 years from now, do you see that that field would be very regulated as far as, you know, when somebody is trying to sell nitrogen as fertilizer? They have to exactly tell how they're using, or are we going to force our growers to use nitrogen fertilizer, you know, like it's mandatory you have to do. Do you see something like that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to start with emphasizing what Deanna said. Regulation is the only thing that regulates grower activity. And so I think as you look at it, you've got the states, we've got the Iowa Nutrient Management Plan. IDALS has spent just this last year over $14 million in incentives, and so their behavior could be regulated, so to speak, with a little R, by incentives in the marketplace, whether that comes from government incentives, whether that comes from retailer manufacturer incentives to do a certain behavior. I think we're also going to be incentivized in the future by some of our stakeholders. So, in this economic area where we have lower resources for inputs, sometimes those that have operating loans are regulated as to the amount they can spend by their banker in order to keep farming. We all work with insurance companies, and I think we're regulated by that risk management that may be dictated by our partners in the insurance world to cover us. So I think there are many influencers, not just the crop advisors, although I like to think we're the best influencer, but there are many stakeholders within production outside of government that regulate with a small r the behavior and the practices that somebody applies as a grower. And so moving forward, I do think a lot of our stakeholders in the past have kind of left us alone because we haven't had that that threat of wrongdoing. Moving forward, I think the awareness of water quantity, water quality, of soil health, and some of the other issues that are coming to the forefront as of late, I think are really going to present themselves more as a liability, and some of those other organizations will regulate the behavior as well as those influencers within the industry and within, you know, field to market. Another huge influencer, I grow corn and soybeans, so I market my corn and soybeans at the local elevator. You know, I take them to the ethanol plant, I take them to the biodiesel plant, but mostly I don't control the marketing of my product. It is controlled for me. And because it's controlled for me, those people that handle the grain after me may take my totally perfect, no fines, great corn and mix it with their other less quality, number two, yellow, and it goes out as this homogeneous mix of production. And the end user, especially the food companies and everybody that work with Fields Market and some of the other groups, they have a say in our production. And until we realize that if we don't modify or act responsibly in what they define as responsibility, they too will regulate our actions by the marketing of our product. So there are a lot of players, and a lot of players influence the decisions we make on the ground and how we get rid of our crops and how we produce our crops.
Can I take a crack at the, you asked a direct question, and so I'd like to say something about inhibitors. I think that's going to be a state-to-state decision, because the other thing is NRCS and their nutrient management standard, depending on the state you're in, may or may not say, you know, there's a benefit with the inhibitors. And so the important thing about that is that we in our states are working closely with our state NRCS
to have the data to show NRCS that, yeah, in my climate, this product work. In our southern climate, none of the products show any advantage. And so they're not putting into the standard. And their standard sometimes becomes a de facto regulatory standard, because if you get cost share money either federally or by the state, then you have to use their standard. So I think your question is a really good one. And again, what I think the important part here is that we have the research the land grants have the research to show those folks that we're working with. I think that's critically important.
And yes, in Iowa, nitrogen stabilizers are part of the nutrient reduction.
Yeah.
So my name is Kirsten, I'm from Vermont. And we have some new rules on the books that started in 2017 in relation to our very controversial TMDL plan in Lake Champlain that was rescinded due to litigation and now reapproved. And before this, our medium and large farms were under state regulations to have nutrient management plans, so basically 200 cows or equivalent and above. And that was about 25% of our farms. Now we're down a threshold which encapsulates more like 75% of our farms. In addition, I will say, that our Agency of Agriculture, who enforces those plans, had not been doing a very good job of truly enforcing and looking at records. So now they are. So those MFOs and LFOs are like, And now we have all these small farms coming through. We don't have a very good certification program. But we do have inspectors now showing up on farms looking at these nutrient management plans, which in Vermont have to be a NRCS 590 standard. And one of the issues I see sort of bubbling to the top is, the plan, and I'm as an agronomist in the CTA, the plan is a plan, it's a management strategy. And often those inspectors are then looking at records and reconciling them. And I'm wondering what other states are doing to sort of, enforce the plan, but in a realistic, practical way, knowing that the plan sounds great on January 1st, but then the real world hits and weather and, life happens and it's virtually impossible to implement that nutrient plan. So what happens at the end of the year in terms of, auditing records and reconciling, and how does that all work in these other states?
I can maybe try to tackle that a hair bit. So in Delaware, we have a system by which if you need to change your plan during the growing season, you are able to do that. You have to put in a plan amendment with the Department of Ag, but the commission recognizes, the commission being made up of a lot of growers, recognizes that there's variability and that best intentions aren't always followed because of things like weather. We have that winter ban on spreading. We have a mechanism by which if you're a dairy farmer and you have a storage tank that's looking to breach, you'll allow you to put out manure in the winter period. The agency tries to help them plan it at a time where it will have the least amount of impact. I think in our state, we recognize that that's an issue. A lot of our consultants will actually write multiple plans for a field. So my extension agent that works really closely with me, she wrote nutrient management plans in Maryland for several years, and she didn't like to confine a grower to a specific crop or timing, so she puts a lot of flexibility in her plans where she might write it for corn or for full season beans. So if you couldn't get the corn in because it was too wet in the spring, you'd have the opportunity to write or to plant full season beans and not have to get a revision of your plan. We don't have as much enforcement in Delaware we only have 3 people who work for the nutrient management program in the Department of Agriculture, and we have 2,700 people who are certified and about 1,400 people who are private nutrient handlers, which means they have to have a nutrient management plan. So a lot of times our enforcement has been driven by complaints, typically related to manure, the way manure is being staged in the field, or manure storage issues, or composting mortality issues on poultry farms. And that's when our state agency can really get in and if you get called on a complaint, they do then go ahead and evaluate everything that's going on. We've only seen one fine in the state of Delaware, and that was where somebody just pretty much said, I'm not going to fix my problem. We have those guys too. They're like, here's my check, don't ever come here again, kind of thing. But we also have a lot of CAFOs. It was interesting that Erica mentioned the percentage of CAFOs. Our Department of Ag has actually been encouraging all of our poultry farms, pretty much every one of them falls under CAFO size, not necessarily discharge, but they encourage them all to fill out the letter of intent to get a permit, and they're being permitted under a general permit for the whole state as a protection. We tell them it's a protection, and again, that's a time where we can get out, and the Department of Ag folks will do site inspections and make sure that they are following their plan. But I think everyone recognizes that, and unless it's an egregious and blatant ignoring the plan, then I don't see there being a lot of issues. That being said, I know we did have a grower in Maryland who also grows in Delaware, and he accidentally over-fertilized his dry corners, and he was fine. So it depends on where you are, I think, and hopefully I think people recognize that there's just, you can't always do what you said you were going to do.
So most farms aren't getting like an annual inspection of their records?
No. No, so the Chesapeake Bay program, we're coming with the WIP, they're coming to a verification methodology that they both agree on, and it's supposed to be 10% of the farm, of the acres every year.
So can I talk about North Carolina, because we do have annual inspections of all of our liquids. So it's dairy and swine, and almost all of our swine and dairy are under these state nutrient management. And they make sure it's not just, unlike poultry, it's not just a rate, it's also a volume thing. Mm-hmm. And so they're very concerned about that. But I want to talk about the success story of this regulatory program. A lot of the swine industry was just furious when the regulations went into effect. Mm-hmm. And now they wouldn't be without them. Because from their standpoint, from a business standpoint, it protects them to have these annual inspections and show that they're doing a good job. The other thing is, just like in Delaware, if there is a weather event for North Carolina, that means hurricanes, and it means the lagoons filling up and breaching, they have emergency plans in place to handle that. And so they do have that flexibility, which is critical during those times.
Yeah, and I think I'll just add, from when I say states, I'm talking about the state regulatory agencies, the DNR, CEQs. Those that do have the regulatory framework in place, there's not every state, there's few, but those that we've talked to, the enforcement is the last step. And so that there's still the voluntary approach ahead of time to get the conservation on the ground, but oftentimes the enforcement is the last step, and often not even used. In some cases, I know in Washington in particular. So I think, some states have used it as an option for, as Deanna said, making sure that there's justification for what they're doing. But I think we'll see across the country that enforcement piece really is not the focus of the regulatory program.
Yeah, I always give my regulatory friends in Washington crap because they like to say, well, we like the voluntary approach. And it's like, oh, you mean voluntary compliance? Yes. But it is nice when they, they get their kind of first warning of, all right, go work with the conservation district, get this fixed. And if they choose not to do anything, then there's consequences. But we're running over on time, and I don't think anybody else is coming into the room, so feel free to leave if you need to leave, but I'd be happy to keep fielding questions for a little bit. Is that okay with everybody? I think we've got one more.
I have a question for Deanna. I understand the trading scheme, what do you think it'll morph to? And I was very interested in how that allocation of the 35% reduction was distributed amongst.
So I have to be really careful how I say this. A lot of the trading is being driven by a political ideology, right? And I think what's truly going to happen with the trading scheme is that there will be trades. But my fear is that it's going to greatly penalize the agricultural community, because while the agricultural community is trading, while they're providing the urban sector credit, they're supposed to also be getting their reductions at the same time. How in the world do you do that? Furthermore, this is a rapidly urbanizing watershed, as you saw by the map. There's not, I mean, my biggest fear is that this is going to drive agriculture out. So, you know, in the short run, the urban areas may get a benefit from this. In the long run, it's not going to protect water quality one bit. And the worst part is, and I didn't say this, is that our state government has changed. And as a consequence, they said, well, nobody has to do anything for, you know, 5 years anyway. And so we're going to try some algicides.
Great. Any other audience?
One last question. My question is related to what is the city you are taking on at Kola? Because what I have seen, like, I work for CHS. So I work for CHS in Manpower. And we have been nominated to be an advocate for Kola initiative. But I'm not seeing much initiative taken at the lower level, you know, like at the small retail office level where you encourage people to participate in Kola initiative.
Okay.
And also, you know, I'm also saying that certified crop advisors and the board are much involved. And you know, I have that CCA, my friend has that certification. But there was a point we were thinking, why do we have that? There's no benefit of having this. And I think it's the same thing across the board. So CCA has been a money-making agency.
So I'm glad, thank you for asking the question. And so this is regarding basically why put the effort into 4Rs, kind of in a nutshell. And I'm glad you asked that, because with my past job, one of the things that I had to do for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, in addition to determining which research projects we were going to fund and who, what the priorities were going to be and that sort of thing, was every single water quality report. And if you're familiar with Minnesota at all, we have, between the TMDL, the Water Restoration Protection Strategies, One Watershed, One Plan, we're doing watershed-based analyses now. There are a lot of reports going out each year. So for every single report that came out, I was responsible for reading it, reviewing it, and giving comment on behalf of agriculture. One of the things that I noticed was missing from most of these discussions of implementation was nutrient management, was what were we going to do at the field level? Most of the discussions were, how many practices are we going to put on the landscape? And so thinking about structural practices, so buffers, bioreactors, so those kind of practices. If we don't start the discussion with nutrient management, then we're missing a whole part of the system. And so I think that that's what 4Rs does, is it starts with what's happening on the field. It makes sure that we're the producers, and that there's this discussion between the retailers, the CCAs, the producer, on what's the best way for them to make a profit, protect the environment, and then also, you know, avoid some of these questions about regulation. And so what can be done at the field scale before thinking about that Band-Aid at the at the end of the watershed. And so that's where I think it gets a different level of discussion. It gets different people engaged in the discussion. And that's what I've seen that has been missing all along as we talk about implementation plans in Minnesota, is a discussion with all of those involved at the field level.
Great.
I realize I'm not a panel member, but I have to jump in on the discussion because No,
this
is perfect.
I've been over 25 years as the chair, and what you said exactly, I've heard over and over and over again. And I'd say this with regard to nuclear management. You personally, you as an individual, may not be beneficial depending on your job function. But from a from the kind of framework here, one of the things I think you see is we have regulatory agencies. When we talk about, and most of our CCAs are employed by retail agribusiness. The state EPA or whatever regulates inside the fence or inside the boundaries of that, with containment and all the different things. The regulatory agency then, another regulatory agency maybe, picks up regulation at the edge of the stream. Well, between that fence and between that edge of the stream, how do you deal with that thing? I think that's what you're talking about, Heidi, because that gets into nutrient management or pesticide management or that sort of thing. And you just, how do you regulate that? So in many cases, and California, I think, was a pretty good example, they were facing groundwater quality problems, and it was batted back and forth. Does NRCS pick it up? Does the California Department of Ag pick it up or whatever? The CCA program was in place, not a lot of them, but it was in place, and it provided a way for a voluntary program to come into play and fill that gap for California. So in those certain areas of California, you're required to have a CCA. Now, you don't have a state agency that does the testing or does all that thing. It's self-supported, it's voluntary. So that in Ohio, I believe, and you know, some other places is starting to build a bill there. So for you, sometimes solutions to individual problems are quite different from solutions to institutional problems. Okay.
Yeah. Did you say that to me, that your Delaware certification program, the planners, that they have, that's part of the CCA, is their CCA?
So not all of our planners are CCAs, but our nutrient management exam for our planners is the same one we give as the regional nutrient management exam for the CCAs. So if we have a planner that wants to be a CCA, they don't have to retake that piece of the exam. They just need to take the ICAM and the general exam.
Great. Well, here, I'll move that down. Well, I think with that, I'd like to thank everybody for coming. I'm going to set a sign-up sheet up here, and just name and email if you'd like to kind of stay engaged in this conversation inside the Tri-Societies. I hope and plan to do a similar session again next year, or at least propose it, and hopefully we can get it on the agenda again. So if you want to kind of stay aware of that and maybe present next year or be a part of the panel, please give me your name and email address, and we can kind of start maybe a little mini community or whatever you want to call it, of just a place where we can share experiences and stuff like that. I think there's a lot of really great examples of how, you know, members of the three societies here have plugged in and influenced regulation, policy, incentives, you know, across the country. And I don't think that's called out as much as it could be. And I think that there's a lot of wisdom and lessons learned there that I think would be really good to do a better job of promoting and highlighting, so that those of us that are, you know, respond or tasked with either reviewing or developing or implementing those policies, we've got some resources and some folks to tap into. So with that, I'd like to thank all of our panelists here for their time and their wisdom.